What if this isn't all random? What if there's a reason for all this? Once upon a time, there were a group of faith-filled people living in a place that wasn't their home, but it had become their home. It was about 500 years before the time of Jesus' birth, and the Persian Empire was ascendant. It was a vast empire ruled by a king named Ahasuerus. He sometimes gets called Xerxes, and you'll see that in some of your translations of the Bible. But today I'm going to use the term Ahasuerus because it sounds cooler. Ahasuerus made his home in a place called Susa. And that was, therefore, the center of political intrigue for the Empire of Persia. About a century before Ahasuerus, many of the inhabitants of the defeated nation of Israel had been carried off into exile there, which we're told in the biblical story was a result of a couple of centuries worth of not doing an especially notable job of being faith-filled people. The people of God hadn't been especially effective in being a light to the nations, ergo, a timeout was in order. After about 70 years of reflection on this state of affairs during exile, a portion of the Jewish population were, by the grace of God and by the peculiar intervention of a Persian king named Cyrus, remembered by, especially by the Jewish people, as Cyrus the Great. Because of Cyrus and the grace of God, they were permitted to return to Israel. But the Persian exile wasn't perceived by all to be a terrible time, and interestingly, a good-sized portion of the exiled people chose to stay in Persia. They'd found a way to make it work. A small ethnic group in a dominating culture. It was home for some. But it had its risks because Jews were a minority in that culture and minority groups, and for some reason, especially the Jews. Sometimes minority groups become the whipping boys and girls for all sorts of things, both real and imagined. The book of Esther describes one such occasion. In the first chapter of the book, we're introduced to Ahasuerus, and we discover that the queen of the day is someone named Vashti. The setting is the third year of his reign, and we discover that Ahasuerus really likes a good party. I mean, he really likes an over-the-top shindig. In fact, he has thrown a blowout celebration that lasts half a year, 180 days. And it's a command performance for those in positions of influence in his empire, an empire that we're told stretches from India all the way to Ethiopia. And this party is a display of his power. This is the boss's Christmas party. You cannot say no. You have to be there with that smile plastered on your face, seemingly having a good time, or else. At the end of 180 days of forced merriment, Ahasuerus decides that another seven-day wingding is in order for all the good burgers of Susa. Everybody in the city gets to come. And it's a wild celebration. The text tells us that this was an event of two-handed drinking. And I quote chapter 1, verse 8, "Drinking was by flagons without restraint." People's livers were crying out, "No more, no more." But they pressed on. We also discovered that there was some segregation of the sexes here. The Persians of the day believed in some sort of parallel partying, I guess, because it seems that the lovely Mrs. Ahasuerus, Queen Vashti, was holding a separate party for the ladies. As the 7 days came to an end, Ahasuerus figures this would be a good time for his guests to get an eyeful of Vashti, who we're told is one fine-looking example of Persian beauty. And so he sends for her, and I know this will surprise some of you, but she says, not in this lifetime, honey, or words to that effect. Note to self, after spending 180 days of partying and drinking by flagons, do not call my spouse to participate in a beauty pageant. Write that down, Phil. This is advice we can all use, I know. If you remember nothing else this morning, remember that. The king doesn't respond too well to this. Clearly, half a year of debauched revelry has not granted him deep insight into his spouse's character. And he's also left looking like a bit of a goof. And he's looking like a goof in front of all these people he's trying to impress, if not intimidate. So what's a king to do? Well, you call a meeting of your best and brightest. And this brain's trust quickly realizes that there might be some sort of Persian societal collapse if women started refusing en masse to parade themselves in front of drunk banqueteers. So he is advised that it's time for a new queen. And Vashti retires to presumably spend her remaining days on the shores of Maui. And her part of the story is now over. So ends chapter 1 of the Book of Esther. Chapter 2 is no less action-packed. We are now introduced to a couple of Jewish folk who stayed on in Persia. The two main characters, Esther, who was an orphan, and her cousin, Mordecai, who raised her and served as her guardian. The introduction is a result of the now sober and rather lonely King Ahasuerus pining away for a new queen. Well, a plan is hatched. There will be a kingdom-wide search for a new queen, and it's an elaborate one. And by the time the chapter is over, our heroine Esther is clearly the best candidate. The twist in the story is that nobody in positions of power, not the king or his courtiers, are aware that Esther is Jewish. And her cousin and protector Mordecai tells her that she would be wise to keep this little detail of her life to herself. And Mordecai, he just kind of hangs out near the palace, right at the gate, just to make sure that she's okay. And while he's there, he eventually discovers a plot against the king. And that's intelligence that he passed on to Esther, who in turn tells the king, who is, as a result of this, even more delighted in his choice of queen. I mean, it's an amazing thing, isn't it? Here's a Jewish woman who finds herself as queen of Persia. It's amazing because in the very next chapter we discover that Ahasuerus has appointed a fellow named Haman to the position, or a position of power in the royal court. And as it turns out, Haman hates the Jews. And that obviously adds a wee bit of tension in this story. And our fondness for Haman is even lessened when we discover that the rule is that people have to kneel for him, for Haman, at the king's gate. And in a most peculiar twist of fate, who am I trying to kid here? It's one of these intriguing, God-soaked plot lines. Mordecai, who I remember is the person who kept hanging out at the gate, Mordecai refuses to bend his knee to Haman. And all sorts of people are saying, come on, Mordecai, just do it. It isn't worth the aggravation, but he won't. This is one of those deadly points of principle that usually gets us into trouble. And when Haman hears about Mordecai's refusal and his heritage, it's not enough that he wants to eliminate Mordecai for this slight, but he also uses this as a convenient excuse to kill all the Jews in Persia. And he selects the date of this empire-wide execution by throwing dice. Interestingly, this event in the biblical story and the Jewish faith is celebrated in the festival called Purim. It happens early each spring of each year. Next year it starts on the evening of March 23rd and concludes on the evening of March 24th. This year it was on the 4th and 5th of March. And note that Purim is a fairly lively do. It's not the 187 days of partying that Ahasuerus had, but it's supposed to be a time of substantial feasting and, yes, drinking. It is a time to be immoderate. There was a time when the rabbis of yore suggested that it was okay to drink until you didn't know the difference between Mordecai or Haman, the heroes and the villains of this story. And let's not get too excited about getting in touch with our Jewish roots, okay? Let's just leave that for at least the next year. But Purim is a blowout party because it's about something that was so important to God's unfolding plan for the world, and that was the survival of God's people. So I mention this because this name, Purim, comes from the Hebrew word pur, which is a word that means lots, or as we would say today, dice. It is the festival of dice. So the die were thrown, and it's determined that the opportune time for the killing would be in 11 months. Haman then goes to the king and tells them how the Jews in the country don't obey the law, and he asks for permission to kill them all, and Ahasuerus, being the wise fellow that we've already discovered him to be, he tells him to go for it. Mordecai hears this, and he's overwhelmed. And he puts on the traditional signs of grief, sackcloth and ashes, and he stands there outside the gates. And Jews across the empire join him in this time of grieving. Queen Esther hears about Mordecai's action and sends for him. And in doing so, the penny now drops for Mordecai, who has a glimmer of hope. Because he's the only one who knows that Esther is a Jew, and maybe she just might be able to intervene with the king somehow. Now, Esther knows that this is no simple conversation with the king. There's no sidling up and saying, gee, honey, let's not be too hasty here. See, she might be the queen, but she doesn't actually have much power. She really doesn't. Because the tradition and the rules in Persia are quite clear. You don't appear when the king calls, you're out. Former Queen Vashti is exhibit A in this matter. But the opposite is no less a problem. You can't go to the king without an invitation that will get you on the next train out of town too. But Uncle Mordecai, he didn't believe the coincidences are always coincidences. Could it be that this long string of odd events, Vashti's refusal, this empire-wide beauty contest, this hidden Jewishness of Esther, Mordecai began to wonder if Esther might just be the right person in the right place at the right time. And so he says to her, wouldn't it be just like God? Wouldn't it be just like God to have you where you are, who you are, for just such a time as this? Do you ever think about that? That there was a reason for things, and that there might be one particular moment when you could do or say something that no one else could do or say? Esther thinks a bit and she says to Mordecai to get the Jewish people to begin praying and fasting for the next 3 days. She and her retinue will also fast, and when the 3 days are up, well, at the end of chapter 4 we read her statement. After that I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. If she died for this action, so be it. After the 3 days of fasting, she goes to the king in what would normally be seen as a capital crime. And he responds with great generosity. Can you believe Esther's good fortune? The king is actually tickled to see her. Thinks she's just the bee's knees, loves the ground that she hovers above. He welcomes her with open arms, and he says she can have whatever she likes, even up to half of her kingdom. The king is absolutely crazy about Esther. And she says to him that what she'd like most in the world is to have dinner that very night with the king and with Haman. And you got to know that Haman is just thrilled to be included with the king's most intimate partner. The dinner is a massive success. Hey, Esther's got this hosting thing worked out perfectly. And at the end of the night, she works it out that they can do dinner again. Oh, yes. And the second dinner, which is where our text for today picks up, that too is a barn burner. And she steps up and speaks of Haman's hellish plot to destroy the Jewish people and reveals the truth that she is indeed Jewish. And so Haman is revealed to be someone who wants to kill none other than the king's beloved wife and ace party planner, which you should remember by pure coincidence is the king's weak spot. He's a sucker for parties. Hazarus, he storms out of the room and he leaves Haman there doing what he can to keep things together. And he slimes his way up by Esther. And he's right there begging for her favor when the king arrives back and he notices, well, my gosh, Haman, he's right there by my bride. He's far, far too close. I don't like the looks of that. And so he has him hung. Yep, on the very same scaffold that Haman was preparing for Mordecai. And you'll never believe it. But it turns out that Mordecai had rendered some important services to Ahasuerus, and quite amazingly, he gets appointed to Haman's old job. And while he can't overturn the king's decree to exterminate the Jews, he does ask the king if he can permit the Jewish people to defend themselves when the order is eventually carried out. You can't turn back that order. And the king, who I think it's fair to say would truly benefit from some fairly intense therapeutic intervention into his life, oy, he's good to go with that. And so the Jewish people in all 127 provinces of Persia are ruthlessly attacked, and there is a great loss of life. But wouldn't you know it, it's the attackers who suffer the great loss of life. They are roundly defeated. And the closing portion of our passage today explains the institution of the Feast of Purim, the Feast of Luck, the dice. One of the odd and distinctive things about the book of Esther is that God never gets mentioned anywhere. Read through it and you will not find God even once referenced. It's strange that God is not out front. Stuff just happens. There is this long series of intriguing, and for Esther and Mordecai and the Jewish exiles in Persia and elsewhere, it seems like there's just this long string of lucky coincidences. I was involved in an online conversation with a group of church folk about a month ago. And the conversation got to be about whether you could believe, or pardon me, whether you had to believe in God to be a minister in the United Church of Canada. You really can't make this stuff up, can you? By the way, we had the same conversation during one of our supper hours on the course I took this last week. And if, please take some comfort that the unanimous opinion of the people at my table was a strong yes. And in fact, they were said you actually need to have a little more than just believe in God. It was quite refreshing. Anyway, the dominant opinion on the online conversation was, yeah, you have to believe in God. Though not 100%, strangely enough. But anyway, whatever. But there was also a surprising amount of support in that particular group, the online group, for this notion of a non-interventionist God. That is a God who exists, but doesn't actually intervene in human affairs. A kind of creator who made the earth and pretty much stepped back after that. This is a God who doesn't cause stuff to happen in our lives. And frankly, that is not the God we meet in the pages of Scripture. That is not the God we meet in the Bible. That kind of distant God, as compassionate as this God might be, frankly, ain't much use. If that's all we've got, I'm going to go do something else. Because, you see, I found I need a God who acts. I need a God who does stuff. And now, is this a God who is my, like my servant who answers my every request the way I want it answered? Well, no, not even close. In fact, God's responses are often ones that surprise and confound and disturb me. But strangely enough, they seem to have the effect of moving me just a little closer to the image of Christ. Strange how that works. And a lot of time, this God is not obvious. Not absent. Just not obvious. It makes me pay attention to the edges of things, to the unexpected, but those strangely timely conversations, to odd things happening, to coincidences. And that makes me wonder if they weren't just coincidences. Maybe they are in fact the fingerprints of God on life. Obviously, I can't speak for you, but I confess that there are times when I realize that I don't fit in. My perspective and my values are really quite different from those around me. It's like I'm in exile here in my own life. In my own country and in my own community, there are times when I feel like I'm in exile, that I don't fit. Sometimes we even feel like exiles, we feel like strangers in our own families. Take heart. This is not uncommon for followers of Jesus. I would dare say it's one of the signs of being a follower of Jesus. And I would also suggest to you that this is going to become more and more and more pronounced for members of the church, for Christians everywhere in coming years. We circled that issue a lot in the course I was doing this last week. I'll eventually tell you a bit about it. It's not a small part of why we're needing to clarify our direction for the next few years. This church, like all churches here, we are no longer living in familiar territory. It changed on us. And so doing what we used to do, going home in some way, we can just go back home. It's not a realistic option. Home isn't there anymore. It's like we're entering an age of exile. And I guess it's our turn. It's our turn. And to live faithfully, we're going to have to learn some new skills. And we will. We'll be okay. Most of us have lived through much worse than this. And God travels with us. And God will see us through. Of that, I have no doubt. I have no doubt because promises were made and they will be kept. You read the Gospels. Read Paul's writings. Read John's writings. Heck, read through the whole of the Old Testament. This is all leading somewhere. And that somewhere is really, really good. But on the way, it's going to be bumpy. It always has been. And it will surely continue to be until the kingdom is fully realized. And as we move through this time, like Esther, we're going to find ourselves in unexpected places. And we're going to have to remember who we are. We're going to have to remember our story. Because it's a different story than the world around us has as a story. Our story is different. Like Esther, we're ordinary people in an extraordinary situation. And if we're paying attention, we'll see that strangely enough, we just might be the right person in the right place at the right time. The kingdom of God is made up of such people. Ordinary folks in surprising places who know who they are and who know their story. And I suppose it could be at a party sometime or at work or it could be downtown at QF or it could be at school or in the hospital. But there'll be a moment. There will be a moment when your story, when who you are, and what you've, and how you've been equipped, when that will matter. And if you look back at how you got to where you are, and if you listen carefully, You know, you might just hear someone saying, maybe the Lord is calling you for such a time as this. Who knows? Amen.